This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, Tom Ricks and Vernon Loeb, cover the military for The Washington Post and have been writing about the military preparations for war with Iraq. They've written about the U.S. military's unrivaled power and its new high-tech weapons, but they've also described the strains that are showing as the military readies for war with Iraq while fighting a war on terrorism and preparing for possible action against North Korea. Tom Ricks has covered military activities in Somalia, Korea, Bosnia, Kuwait, the Persian Gulf, and Afghanistan. He wrote about the military for the Wall Street Journal before joining the Washington Post. He was part of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams of reporters covering military preparations for the 21st century and the war on terrorism. Vernon Loeb was the Post's intelligence and national security correspondent before covering the Pentagon. He covered the Gulf War and served as the Southeast Asia correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer before joining the Washington Post. In a recent piece that you both wrote, you said that the United States now stands astride the globe more dominant than any armed force since the legions of the Roman Empire. What's different now for us?
Basically, the U.S. military over the last 10 years has harnessed the information revolution and really moved into information age warfare. No other military in the world is there. And it's hugely different, not just from every other military, but from the U.S. military we had at the beginning of the Gulf War. When the Gulf War began, Colin Powell, then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as he watched the video of the first cruise missile launch, said, "Now we're going to see if these things work." They had that level of doubt about their own technology. They don't have that level of doubt about their own technology now. The U.S. military is hugely confident that its technology is going to work this time.
You also write that some of the commanders who have known nothing but victory are confident to the point of cockiness. How have you seen that expressed?
Basically, when I spent a good part of January knocking around the U.S. military in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and aboard an aircraft carrier, there's a sense that these people know how good they are. They are very, very good. It's a real contrast to the mood of the commanders going into the Gulf War. Barry McCaffrey, who commanded the 24th Infantry Division of the Gulf War, told me that when they got off the plane in Saudi Arabia in August 1990, they had no food, no beds, and no idea what they were doing there. They had never been there before. Now you have a U.S. military that's fought there for 10 years, that has done constant training rotations through Kuwait. They know what they're about. They know what they're doing there. And there's a little worry at the margins. It's not a core worry, but at the edges you hear a little bit of worry inside the military and out about hubris, about, you know, pride going before a fall, or people figuring out what the vulnerabilities are of the U.S. military.
You say that we're so much more militarily advanced than our allies that the Pentagon doesn't necessarily like to fight alongside the allies because it may slow down the U.S. forces. That's an unusual way of looking at it. Is that really a concern, that our allies would slow us down?
Yeah, they wouldn't just slow us down. They wouldn't be able to play the same game we play. The only ally we're really comfortable fighting with at all is Britain, and the others just simply play a different game than we do. I mean, the U.S. military is into, you know, digital age combat. It's not just the ability to hit a target, but it's the ability to move information around the battlefield so quickly that you can hit a target while it's still moving on the battlefield. And the U.S. military and perhaps the Brits are the only military that can come close to doing this.
Is that one of the reasons, possibly, that President Bush doesn't seem that concerned about not having more allies going into this war?
I think it probably is because the Pentagon's view of the world really does permeate, I think, this administration's assessment. And it led into a kind of a dead end in that neither France nor Germany is really a militarily significant country at this point. It sounds harsh to say it, but it is true as a military assessment. They simply do not have the ability to project power globally. They can't move forces, and when they get there, they really don't have very adept forces. As individual soldiers, they have all the bravery in the world. But as units, they don't. They're not very good militarily. And I think that really did enter into the Bush administration's assessment. We don't need these people. These people are actually kind of an impediment on the battlefield. At the same time, they're finding it makes it much harder to go to the war that they're, I think, determined to go into because of that lack of support. The other worry is also that while you may not need these people in the fight, you do need them in the peacekeeping, the post-Saddam Iraq, and it's going to be harder to get them there now.
And do you think that because the United States has such superior military capability, unmatched by any country, that that the use of that military is entering more into like political strategy.
The military term for this is when the only tool you have is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail. The military calls it the militarization of foreign policy, and there are worries about this.
What are they?
That the military is so good at what it does that it tends to be the tool of first resort rather than the last. And this is not just an ideological or partisan view. I mean, Bill Clinton seemed very fond of firing cruise missiles off during his presidency. I once figured out that I think he fired an average of one every 3 days in his presidency, if you took all the cruise missiles he used during his presidency to hit Sudan, Afghanistan, Iraq. And this administration came in saying, no, we're not going to do nation building. We're not going to go and use the forces at that high an operational level. Yet they already have had a war in Afghanistan. They look like they're moving into a war with Iraq. And occupying Iraq is going to take huge numbers of troops for a long time. The military feels that every foreign policy question seems to have a military answer.
At the same time that we're preparing for this probable war in Iraq, we have military commitments in other parts of the world, peacekeeping missions in the Balkans, the war, rebuilding Afghanistan, the war on terrorism, a threat from North Korea. In your assessment, I mean, do you think the military can handle all of that? And what kind of reaction have you been getting from commanders and other military people you've been speaking to about their feelings about whether the U.S. military can support that much action?
When I was knocking around Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf region last month, it was really striking to me that on the one hand, they do feel very confident. On the other hand, they feel tired. One guy made the point that he'd been in the Air Force 7.5 years and had done 7 tours of duty in Saudi Arabia in that time. They make the point that the U.S. involvement in World War II lasted about 4 years. They've been out there doing these sort of things now. The U.S. military has been dealing with Iraq now for 12 years. And even if you get Iraq concluded, you're still going to have an occupation there, and you might have other engagements coming up in the Middle East. So they feel like they've kind of entered into an age of continuous warfare. And I think they don't feel well understood by the American people back here that this is not a sustainable pace for the people in the U.S. military, that being deployed for 220 days a year indefinitely will ruin your marriage. People are worried about their families, about not seeing their kids grow up.
This must be an issue for a lot of people because, as you've pointed out in your writing, the military is older than it used to be, and also more people in it are married.
It's very much a married military, and this is one of the consequences of the end of the draft. Rather than fill out the ranks with 18-year-olds who are going to be there for 1.5 or 2 years or something, it's people who are making a career of it, 20 or 30 years. But it is a real concern in the military that they're going to wind up breaking the force. You hear this, the Army especially talks about it. The Army's kind of internal lobbying organization called the Association of the United States Army, which is basically a group of retired generals, has been running essays in their own magazine warning that if the current pace of operations keeps up, they are going to break the force.
What does that mean?
It means that as they put it, you will return to Vietnam-like conditions, Vietnam-era-like conditions in the U.S. Army, with a demoralized force, with people leaving, with good, seasoned, experienced people leaving, being replaced by less experienced, less trained, and less capable people, and it becomes a much less capable military.
My guests are Tom Ricks and Vernon Loeb. They cover the military for The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Vernon Loeb and Tom Ricks. They cover the military for The Washington Post. Let's look a little bit at exactly what kind of weapons we're going to be using now in this new, very high-tech military. What are some of the new high-tech innovations that will let the military do things it was unable to do before?
Well, the military's smart bomb of choice right now is a satellite-guided bomb that was developed after Desert Storm when the primary bomb was a laser-guided bomb. The problem with laser-guided bombs was they don't work when it's cloudy or when it's dusty in the battlefields. The haze, obstructs the laser beam. So after Desert Storm, the military decided it needed an all-weather precision-guided bomb. So they basically took the laser-guided bomb and they added a GPS receiver to it, which means the bomb is dropped from an airplane. It has its own inertial guidance system. It starts steering it to the target, and every second it gets an update from Global Positioning System satellites. and this enables the bombs to strike within about 10 meters or less of their target in all weather. So that'll be the starring smart bomb of the next Iraq war. And similarly, GPS receivers have been added to Tomahawk cruise missiles, which are fired from sea, so that our precision strike capabilities have increased enormously since Desert Storm, when I think it was 9% of the bombs, only 9% of the bombs dropped were precision-guided bombs. This time around, it'll probably be more like 90%.
One thing I would add to that is, while the next war in Iraq will look on the television in many ways very similar, that's because the platforms, ships, aircraft, are basically the same. What's really different about the U.S. military is what's inside them. Basically, the information revolution has come home to roost in the U.S. military. You know, the reliance that the U.S. society has in our business and personal lives on email to move information around has its parallel in the U.S. military over the last 10 years. So now you have images going from aircraft over the battlefield back to headquarters in, say, Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, instantly also shipped to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, and to intelligence analysts across the country who are then looking at it, responding to analysts back in Saudi Arabia who then communicate information back into the cockpit of a pilot still in flight.
Now, during the Gulf War in 91, the smart bombs looked really smart and different from anything we'd seen before. When the war was over, we learned that some of the smart bombs made mistakes, or if the bombs didn't make mistakes, some of the people guiding the bombs made mistakes. Is the military expecting that the smart bombs this time around, even though they're more high-tech, will make errors too?
Well, smart bombs are dependent upon smart intelligence. I mean, you can hit with great precision exactly the wrong thing, as we saw them do during the Kosovo War when they used satellite-guided bombs to destroy the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, thinking it was actually a Yugoslav arms bureaucracy. So smart bombs are very dependent upon good intelligence, which we're sometimes not that great at. The ability to hit a target with precision, we have pretty much mastered. The ability to do so with the kind of intelligence we need is something we're still working on, and in fact, a lot of people say we're not nearly good enough at yet.
No, a lot of the military is very high-tech now. You know, we're talking about smart bombs and this, you know, email-like system of communication hooking up the battlefield to the CIA at home. What about the ground troops, the soldiers on the ground? Do they have high-tech stuff, or are they basically fighting as if it were World War II?
To a surprising degree, they don't. When we're talking about the email military, keep the U.S. Marines out. I actually got an email this morning from a Marine in Kuwait who said, as soon as the war begins, I'm off the net. You're not going to hear from me. It amazes me how disproportionately we do not spend on our ground forces. I don't know why this is. I've covered the military for over a decade, and I'm still deeply puzzled by it. Why we have satellites that can see license plates from outer space, but we still have troops probing the battlefield with sticks to look for mines.
I mean, I read that the troops are going to be carrying about 100 pounds on their backs. That's a lot.
That's a good day. I've seen people carry 120, 150.
Really? What's in there?
Well, you need everything to live with, as if you're going on a camping trip. And then you need your weaponry. And you know what? And then the ammunition for the weaponry and the ability to keep that weapon working if it's a machine gun or something. And then you need your chemisuit and your chemical protection and a gas mask. And then you have a little medical kit hanging off you. Don't forget, it's the desert. You better have a couple of quarts of water hanging off you at all times. And then you have body armor. Body armor is actually the one change I've seen in the military, is they're much more willing to give the infantry good stuff that actually can stop at least some small caliber weapons. That was not true 15 years ago. You're seeing it more and more these days. It's one of the lessons learned from the Battle of Mogadishu, from Black Hawk down, is that a little body armor can really help forces survive.
Now, what about the chemical bioweapons suits that the ground troops have to carry with them that they really might have to wear? Do you get the sense that the troops have confidence in these suits, or that their commanders have confidence in these suits?
I think they do. We're now actually, I think, on a second or third generation suit, a step up from what they had in the Gulf War. Again, they're very rigorously tested, but you know, they've never been used in combat. They've never been used in the real thing. And I think that's where the real problems would come in. The problems would not be with the suits themselves. It would be with the discipline of the soldiers, putting them on rapidly enough, putting them on in the correct way. If you put on a gas mask and the seal is not correct around your chin, it does you no good whatsoever. So you've really got to train repeatedly, putting these things on, putting them on quickly enough, making sure once you have them on, you keep them on, and you've put them on in the right way. I think those are where all the uncertainties come in.
How much have you been able to learn about what the U.S. military strategy is for entering Iraq?
I've written several stories about this over the last 7 or 8 months. We've kind of watched this process unfold. There has been a lot of talk about it, partly because it's been a vigorous process inside the Pentagon. There's been a lot of argument back and forth. It started off with some people talking about an Afghanistan-like approach of using a few special forces on the ground, working with indigenous fighters, to pull in U.S. airstrikes. And it's evolved to what other people now call Desert Storm Light, a smaller version of the Gulf War. And then from there to kind of more something that looks more like a heavy, big version of the Panama invasion that a lot of people have forgotten about, where the U.S. came in overnight and simultaneously hit targets across Panama, I think 45 targets in the first night, landing troops on them and also conducting airstrikes. So I think you're going to see that sort of 1989-like Panama version updated with a higher-tech, information-laden military. That's what they hope to pull off. Another thing I point out is that it may not begin, like a lot of people expect, with cruise missiles in downtown Baghdad. That may come at the end of the equation rather than the beginning. There's no particular reason to start off with that. You might want to hit a few what they call high-value targets, the pillars of the regime, maybe where you think Saddam Hussein is, maybe a few weapons of mass destruction spots that you think you can safely hit from the air without setting up a plume of poisons. But you also might see what they call a soft launch in marketing, of moving in and protectively taking oil fields, of putting troops into the north and in the west, and biting off big chunks of Iraq without much fighting.
Americans were just, I think, shocked by the amount of force used at the opening of the Gulf War, the amount of American military force. Do you think that it's likely to have that much or even more military force on the opening night, for instance, or opening day?
I think there will be a multiple of that amount of force, but it'll be done simultaneously across Iraq and mainly won't be visible.
What do you mean it won't be visible?
Well, you're not going to have people out in the oil fields, reporters necessarily. You're not going to have TV cameras capturing where it's occurring.
Oh, I see what you're saying. If it's way out in the Iraqi desert. Mm-hmm.
So it may happen off stage, as it were.
Right. And what do you think the U.S. military is preparing for Iraq to do if we start the war?
I think the main thing they're expecting Iraq to do is to disperse its forces and fall back into Baghdad and perhaps into the regional cities, having learned the lesson from the Gulf War, which was, you know, when you amass your forces on the battlefield, you are sitting ducks for American technology. There's also a belief that Saddam Hussein spent quite a bit of time studying Yugoslavia from 1999 and learning the Serbian lesson of decoys sometimes even with the heat source. So a decoy with a heat source to one of our infrared sensors looks like a tank when in fact it's not a tank. And also, again, the dispersion of forces. When your forces are in a city, not massed, just dispersed in very small groupings, they're very hard to hit from the air. And it's a great equalizer. It's a great way to neutralize the U.S. technological advantage. So I think that's what they're expecting from Saddam Hussein's elite forces. I think the expectation, and this will be, it'll be interesting to see whether this is correct, but I think one of their main expectations is that the regular Iraqi military, about 400,000 people, are not going to fight. They feel the fight will boil down to ultimately the U.S. military against the Republican Guard and the Special Republican Guard, which are basically regime preservation forces amassed around Baghdad.
And I think the United States has already been telling people in the Republican Guards and their commanders that since the United States will win if there is a war, that they might as well surrender, not fight, and therefore they'll be good guys after the regime change as opposed to bad guys who will be punished by the United States. How are they going about doing that? How's the United States military going about sending out this message?
Well, supposedly they've even sent email. They've gotten into email accounts and sent them to commanders of units. Not only just telling them that, you know, if you don't fight us, you have a chance of surviving even and being part of the post-Saddam Iraqi military, but also telling them that we know who you are and we know where to find you if your unit uses chemical weapons, and you will be held accountable personally and directly.
Is anybody assessing how effective these communications are?
Well, it's hard to at this point. I'm sure the U.S. military is trying. There are CIA people and special operations people inside Iraq now, and I think they're trying to track that. One of the surprising lessons after the Gulf War was that psychological operations were pretty effective during the Gulf War. When they surveyed POWs who had surrendered and asked them if they had seen American leaflets, about 90%, I believe, said they had seen American leaflets encouraging them to surrender and telling them they wouldn't be harmed. And about half said that they had been encouraged to surrender by those leaflets. So while the military tends to make fun of that sort of thing, you know, the trigger pullers and the bomb droppers, oh, you know, they hate to go out and just do a mission where all they're doing is dropping leaflets, the record says that those do have some effect.
Tom Ricks and Vernon Loeb cover the military for The Washington Post. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Ricks and Vernon Loeb. They cover the military for The Washington Post. They've been writing about how the military is preparing for war with Iraq. Let's pick up where we left off. Saddam Hussein has threatened to set Iraq's oil fields on fire the way he did Kuwait's oil fields. Do you know if the U.S. military has a plan to either prevent that from happening or to minimize the damage of the fires?
I think it's likely to be one of the first steps you see by the U.S. military. There's one reason I was saying don't expect to see cruise missiles in downtown Baghdad as the opening gambit. A smart plan would get to those oil fields and get to dams very early on and prevent them from being destroyed, the oil fields from being torched, or the dams from being blown up. If you blew up the dams and the dikes in southern Iraq, it would make it enormously more difficult for the U.S. military to travel across southern Iraq and to mount an attack in Baghdad. It's a difficult issue, though. Oil fields are long and large. They're hundreds of square miles. So you can't just drop a company of infantry and say, protect this. You have to have supplies. You have to have vehicles to get around. You have to have fuel for those vehicles. It's a difficult military proposition, and I'm sure that some damage will be done to the oil fields early on. On the other hand, keep in mind that the U.S. military had never confronted an issue like this back in 91 when the Gulf War was kicked off. They've been thinking about issues like this for 10 years. They've learned they do indeed have to study the nature of an oil field, where the key vulnerabilities are, where the manifolds are. And I think they will move in on key points in the oil fields very quickly and very early on in any invasion.
But what about, like, remote-controlled explosives? So, you know, Iraq could possibly blow up the oil fields without having any personnel on site to do it.
I'm sure it's a possibility, and I'm sure they're worried about it and trying to figure out how to stop it. There's a very long list of nightmares here. I have to tell you, though, that most of the nightmares, when you talk to senior military officers, most of the nightmares that they talk about are not tactical. That is not part of the battlefield. Yeah, they're worried about chemical and biological weapons. Yeah, they're worried about urban warfare. But what really worries them are the consequences of a war. Internally in Iraq, can you hold the place together after a war? Or do the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north kind of spin off, officially or unofficially, into their own independent worlds? If you do this badly, if it's messier than you expect, if it takes longer, if you have a drawn-out siege of Baghdad, if a lot of civilians are killed by chemical weapons as they drift downwind, these are all things that could really affect the region. And the nightmare scenario is that you really blow it in Iraq, you mess it up, and you destabilize regimes across the region, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, even Pakistan, and wind up with a far bigger problem on your plate than the one you began with.
Do you think that the Pentagon or the, you know, anyone else in the Bush administration thinks that Saddam Hussein might either surrender, flee, or go into exile?
Or get killed by somebody in a coup. I think they're hoping against hope. I'm sure that they're following the Afghan pattern there of trying to spread some greenbacks around and encouraging people to act. Mm-hmm. I mean, a coup would be a whole lot cheaper and easier for the region than any U.S. invasion. And so while, no, they don't like a lot of the diplomatic yammering that's going on now with the Germany and France putting roadblocks in their way, at the same time, it does give them a chance to let that quiet strategy of subversion unfold inside Iraq?
There are special operations forces already in Iraq. To what extent has the war already begun?
It's funny, actually, the lead I wrote on that story when I wrote about it last week was that the question that everybody's asking around Washington is when the war in Iraq will begin, and the answer may be it already has. I mean, what are the classic measures of a war? It's when you have troops on the ground somewhere and when you're bombing almost every day. Well, that's what we're doing in Iraq right now. There are some people in the U.S. military who say the first Gulf War, the 91 Gulf War, never ended. It went into a kind of a low-key phase. We had operations in northern Iraq for years. We had an intense bombing in 1998, the Desert Fox campaign, which is a very effective campaign, and now it's simply escalating again. So, yeah, I think you can make an argument that we've been at war for 10 years, but the signs of an increasing war, of an escalating war, are there right now.
Now, you were talking earlier about how the United States military is so more high-tech than any of its allies are, that the allies sometimes would only slow down the United States as opposed to really helping in a military campaign. What does the military want our allies to do outside of giving bases to the U.S. military?
In a word, peacekeeping. After the war is over, there's going to be a huge demand for troops in Iraq, you know, anywhere from 50,000 to 250,000. And Rumsfeld is no big fan of peacekeeping. He doesn't like to tie up U.S. forces, you know, the world's preeminent fighters, doing peacekeeping. Right now in Afghanistan, you know, who's heading the international peacekeeping mission but Germany? We have 8,000 forces there still doing basically combat patrols, and we're relying on Germany and a whole bunch of other NATO allies to do the peacekeeping there. And that's certainly a model we want to follow in Iraq. So the Pentagon does not want to have three army divisions tied up in Iraq for the next 5 years.
The U.S. military wants to keep Israel out of a war with Iraq. What are the plans that the U.S. military has to keep Israel out and to offer protection to Israel?
Well, we've had troops in the region, I think probably operating out of Jordan, going into western Iraq. The Israelis have also had reconnaissance troops in and out of western Iraq last summer, all for the purpose of making sure that the western Iraqi desert is not a launching pad, either for Scuds or, more likely, for drone aircraft loaded with chemical or biological weapons. I actually think it's going to be easier in this situation than it was in 91 to keep Israel out of the war. Jordan is being much more cooperative now than it was in that conflict. So I think you'll have U.S. forces quietly operating out of Jordan. You'll probably have U.S. aircraft flying out of the Mediterranean Sea off of carriers across Israel and across Jordan into western Iraq, which he did not have in 91. All that, I think, will make it much harder for Iraq to try to get off that strikes against Israel that would regionalize the conflict and make it an Arab-Western conflict. At the same time, during the last war, Saddam Hussein never really was personally threatened with the loss of his regime or his life. This time, that clearly is the U.S. intent. So there is a kind of worry that there's an apocalyptic ending where, as he realizes he's not going to survive, his regime's crumbling, his forces, wherever they are, hidden across mountains out in the desert, do get off a few final shots. And that is a worry that Israel has and I think wants more reassurance from.
How worried is the military that as they're preparing for this war in Iraq or further down the line as they're fighting a war in Iraq, that they won't need to deploy forces to North Korea as well and be, you know, be faced with a conflict on two fronts?
I think they're really worried about that. I think a lot of people in the military see North Korea actually as a greater threat than Iraq, and a greater threat because there's far less they can do immediately to stop North Korea if North Korea wants to do something incredibly provocative. In fact, North Korea is now saying that they're withdrawing from the 1953 armistice that ended the Korean War, so that as the U.S. gets deeper and deeper into Iraq, Korea acts more and more aggressively. So I think that's a large worry for the U.S. military. I think they're also increasingly worried about Al-Qaeda staging terrorist attacks either here in the U.S. somewhere abroad or increasing terrorist-like attacks in Afghanistan in concert with an invasion of Iraq. I think the upper echelons of the military are full of people asking very tough questions about the war, perhaps not to Rumsfeld and Bush, but at least internally. I think there's far more enthusiasm for this war at the White House and among the civilian leaders of the Pentagon than there is among the uniform leaders of the military. The uniform leaders of the military are basically saying, we're confident we can carry out this mission. We'll do the mission if we're told to do the mission. We'll salute like good soldiers. But we have a lot of questions about whether we really need to do this right now.
I have heard some muttering over the last 6 months in the Pentagon. You know, that Clinton administration, they weren't so bad after all. You know, didn't like them back then, but, you know, in retrospect, they were easier to handle, easier to push around than these guys. Rumsfeld has pushed very hard in the military, has said, basically, I'm in control. Thank you very much for your advice. Now I'm going to do what I want to do here. And the military is not used to that. The military got its way much more with the Clinton administration, and they still are getting used to the change.
My guests are Tom Ricks and Vernon Loeb. They cover the military for The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Vernon Loeb and Tom Ricks. They cover the military for The Washington Post. Vernon, you recently wrote about the defense budget and pointed out that the money for war in Iraq and for the rebuilding of Iraq isn't really budgeted in. Where is the money supposed to come from?
Well, it'll come from the deficit, basically. The Bush administration just sent up its new budget. It's the biggest increase of any department in the federal government. It's the sixth straight military increase in a row. And yet it includes no money for the war on terrorism in Afghanistan and no money for the war in Iraq, which will have to be appropriated in a supplemental bill later by Congress. What that basically means is we're going to deficit finance the war. We're running a big deficit now, and we're just going to keep adding to it as we fight the war. So despite this rather large buildup in defense spending over the first 3 years of the Bush administration, it's not nearly enough to pay for the war. And in fact, it's not even nearly enough to pay for the military. We're basically, even with these large increases, having to choose between continuing current systems or discontinuing some of them in order to pay for, you know, research into the newest generation of weapons that Rumsfeld wants. So money is a huge question, and I think it will become a bigger and bigger question as the war rolls along and the debate over defense spending really heats up on Capitol Hill.
So some of the more conventional weapons are getting old because we're spending the money on the new weapons?
If you look at the U.S. military inventory, it was built with the idea that labor was a free good because you could have a draft and you could bring in as many hands as you needed to maintain things, to fix them. With the end of the draft, it took the military about 10 years to recognize it, that maintenance suddenly was a hugely expensive thing to obtain. And so the new military weaponry they're buying, new aircraft, for example, is much easier to fix, much faster to fix. Some of the Cold War aircraft, you have to actually lift off the wing to get on the to get at the engine, on the Harrier, for example. When you repair an F-18, you basically take out one computer card and put in another computer card. The mechanics say it's boring. The pilots say, this is great. I can have my plane back in 15 minutes. That's a huge difference.
Do you get the feeling that the military is competing with Homeland Defense for money?
The military is competing with everybody for money and winning the competition hands down. In fact, the Bush administration is already underfunding Homeland Security and holding the line on everything else while it continues to build up military expenditures. I think the military budget for 2004 is $379 billion. That's more than $1 billion a day, or $42 million an hour, as Rumsfeld likes to point out. The rest of the budget, the rest of domestic discretionary spending, is $316 billion.
Huh.
We spend, a few other comparisons, we spend 10 times what Britain or France does on our military, and we spend twice what all of the other NATO countries combined spend on their militaries.
It was recently announced that journalists will be able to actually cover battles, that journalists will be assigned to accompany combat units in Iraq, which they were not allowed to do during the Gulf War. What kind of tough decisions do you think the reporters with the frontline troops will have to make?
Well, simply going in itself and doing it is a fairly tough decision. When I look at some of the things these reporters are having to do now, to get vaccinations, some of them a little bit scary, to prepare themselves for dealing with the chemical environment. You have reporters looking at the prospect of wearing a chemical suit for days or even weeks at a time. And it's a difficult life. Frontline infantry life is extraordinarily difficult. And I think it's my biggest concern for reporters going into it, is it really is in another world. It's almost a psychotic environment to be in, frontline foot, ground combat. I think just going in is going to be difficult. Once they're in there, there's going to be issues about casualties, how you report casualties, how you talk about them, how you talk about troops who are undergoing enormously emotionally wrenching problems. There's going to be a lot of problems with civilians. You're going to have displaced people across the battlefield. You're going to have refugees. And you're going to have hungry kids and thirsty kids asking troops for food and water. And my experience is that no matter what their orders are, American troops give hungry and thirsty kids food and water. They don't like walking by them.
And they might not have any water for themselves if they do that.
Or they've been told not to do it, or there's always the concern. You see this played out in exercises where the soft-hearted soldier gives the kid food. The kid comes back the next day, gives him food again. The third day, the kid throws an explosive over the fence and blows him up.
Right.
And they teach you, don't do this. Baghdad, no matter how well the war goes, could be a pretty difficult experience. I'm equally worried, though, about the independent reporters. Because of the Gulf War experience, no media fully trusts the promises of the U.S. military here on this. And so every organization is going to have both embedded reporters and independent reporters. And I think it's going to be an enormously lethal environment to be trying to drive an SUV or a Land Rover around in. And you're probably going to see independent reporters flexicuffed by U.S. troops and thrown down in the dust because the U.S. troops don't know who they are. You're going to have U.S. reporters trying to hide out in Baghdad probably as the war begins. And who knows how they'll be treated by civilians angry at having that capital invaded.
Would either of you ever want to be a reporter covering this war where weapons of mass destruction might be used?
Unfortunately, Tom and I are stuck back here at the Pentagon. I think we'd both love to be embedded with one unit or another. I actually covered the Gulf War in Israel, and one of my jobs was to cover the Scud missile landings in Tel Aviv. I've often thought that, you know, had Saddam used his chemical warheads back then, I'd probably be dead. But I think, you know, any military reporter worth his or her salt would love to be out there with the forces.
Tom?
I don't know. It'd be something I have to sit and talk to my wife and my kids about before I went. It's really a job for, ideally, for a single person to be out there on the front lines. At the same time, I'm not that worried about U.S. forces and chemical weapons. The best military answer to a chemical weapons attack is to step on the gas pedal. A lot of civilians don't have that option. But a fast-moving force is very hard to attack with chemical weapons effectively. So I'm not so worried about that. But I am worried about reporters wandering around independently. You could be enormously vulnerable as a reporter. I remember in Afghanistan looking across some minefields and just thinking, you know, if your taxi goes the wrong way, suddenly you're trapped in a minefield. That's what really worries me for reporters.
Yeah, the far more dangerous assignment will be to be an independent foreign correspondent over there. I think the reporters embedded with U.S. forces, by and large, are going to be pretty well taken care of. I'm not convinced that even if you're with the 101st Airborne, the embedded reporters are going to be with the leading edge of that force. I would suspect they'll be somewhat to the rear. But when you're an independent foreign correspondent out there on your own, you can get killed in all sorts of ways. I remember those reporters in Afghanistan who were killed convoying from Bagram to Khost. They just got held up by a bunch of bandits and executed. So it's an extremely dangerous environment, but I'm not sure it's that dangerous for reporters embedded with U.S. forces.
My guests are Vernon Loeb and Tom Ricks. They cover the military for The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Tom Ricks and Vernon Loeb. They cover the military for The Washington Post. Vernon, you were just in and out of Kuwait. You made a really fast trip there over the weekend. You spent more time getting there and getting back than you were actually there. I think you were there for like 7 hours. What did you find out during that 7 hours in Kuwait?
Well, the main thing I found out was that there are no Kuwaitis around, which was kind of surprising. They flew me on a helicopter from Kuwait City down to a new base. They've got about 40 miles south of Kuwait City. And the general I was with was marveling at how there was all this beachfront property and there wasn't a Kuwaiti to be found. The country is full of Americans. The day I was there, the Kuwaiti government ruled the northern half of their country off limits to civilians. So what you've got basically in Kuwait City is the huge American logistics machines, wide-body aircraft coming in one after another, tanks all over the place, and then up north you've got all the forces actually massing. So Kuwait is like a giant U.S. military camp right now.
Tom, one of the things you've recommended to reporters who will be going to cover war in Iraq is that they read Ernie Pyle, the World War II correspondent. What is it that you so respect about the late Ernie Pyle's writing that you think should be a model?
There are a lot of lessons to be gleaned from Ernie Pyle, from his reporting techniques. He pays as much attention to the enlisted troops as to officers. I think especially with today's Ivy League-laden newsrooms, it's all too easy to be swayed by credentials and pay too much attention to officers. I tell myself I know I'm doing my job when I'm talking to sergeants, not talking to generals, that if I've talked to a sergeant lately, I know that I'm doing the good reporting. What I particularly liked in going back and looking at Pyle's essays in the collection called Brave Men is that he didn't just go and look at the glamorous units. He also did really good reporting on units that don't get that much attention. My favorite section in Brave Men is an account of an engineering unit in Sicily. Not much happens in his account. They clear a road, they fill some huge potholes, they build a bridge. But in the course of this, he shows you what they're doing, why it's important, what is significant to these men, and he actually brings them to life. The sergeant in his account of these engineers is the central figure, not an officer. And the sergeant is sort of this bluff, loud guy. I've always thought that Sergeant Hovarth in Saving Private Ryan was based on the sergeant in this engineering unit. He just seems so similar. He's a force of nature. He's this personality he's using to basically get this bridge built at a crucial time so U.S. forces can move forward. We don't get as much Ernie Pyle type reporting as we used to, partly because the U.S. military is warier of having reporters around, partly because we don't have a lot of experienced reporters. There's not that many veterans in newsrooms anymore. So military units are kind of alien beasts to them rather than familiar things that they grew up or spent the time in themselves.
Ernie Pyle died in the war, died covering the war.
Yeah, he was shot in the Pacific near the end of the war.
So that's something to think about, too.
Yes. Unfortunately, yeah.
Right. Is there any way out of war now, do you think? Everybody's been asking this question. I'd be interested in hearing your opinions.
I've been saying for weeks now that it's inevitable. It just seems to me the Bush administration's mind is made up. They're willing to go through another couple of weeks of diplomacy now, but I think basically they've decided that this is a war they have to fight. Better to get it over with now than wait 2-3 months to really no end. So yeah, you can conceive of situations where Saddam suddenly disarms, which strikes me as totally unlikely. You can dream up the exile scenario, but I think the war is going to happen, and I would be very surprised if by mid-March the United States is not at war with Iraq.
During the Gulf War, the first Bush administration's nightmare scenario was that Saddam Hussein, at the very last moment, withdrew his forces up into the northern part of Kuwait but kept the Kuwaiti oil fields. Similarly, my guess is right now, this administration's nightmare scenario is that at the very last moment, Saddam Hussein says, fine, you can have all these biological chemical weapons. I'm sorry I didn't tell the truth. Here they are. And you can have inspectors here for a year or two. We have inspectors. Everything's all over the country. He's totally disarmed. And he says, now leave after 2 years. And everybody says, that's right. The guy fessed up. He's clean. And then he takes that enormous oil revenue and pours it all into acquiring nuclear weapons.
But that's what it would take, I think, to avoid a war at this point.
You've both covered the military for several years. I know you understand the military's need for secrecy on certain war-related information. Is there a place where you draw the line between what the secrecy that a military needs to keep and the secrecy that's kind of above and beyond when it comes to not giving information to journalists?
It comes up all the time. What you don't want to do is endanger troops or endanger current or future operations. You're constantly trying to balance that with the sense that, are the American people being told what they need to know? Are they going in with their eyes open? I wrote a story a week ago about U.S. Special Operations troops inside Iraq. And yes, we were trying to be sensitive to U.S. concerns. We talked to the U.S. government about the story before it ran. We withheld details, the parts that the government asked us to withhold. Nobody asked us not to publish the story, by the way. It's still, I got a lot of hate mail from across the country about it. And I wrote back to these people saying, yes, we have those concerns. We did work with the government on this to try to publish it in such a way that it was not harmful. But you need to keep in mind also that this is a democracy, and if the American people are having a war waged in their name, they should know about it. And I don't want people coming back 2 years to me as a reporter and saying, why didn't you tell us what you knew when you knew it? Why did you hold back? So you're constantly trying to balance those two things.
Tom Ricks, Vernon Loeb, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Ricks and Vernon Loeb cover the military for The Washington Post.